Okay, hey everyone, it's March 26, 2017, and this is your Epercussion episode 90. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi. With me, as usual, are Laurel Black.
Hi.
And Ben Charles. How's it going, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Laurel and I just finished our Virginia Day of State Day of Percussion yesterday at Virginia Tech, so we got home from that late last night, and yeah, shout out to Annie Stevens for just hosting a really, really great day.
Yeah, it was great. We both gave clinics. You gave a masterclass, talked about some of the pieces you play, and I gave a clinic all about alignment, support, and kinesthetic awareness for percussionists.
Yeah, and we got to see the new Virginia Tech Performing Arts Facility, and you guys, it has a room. I wish I remembered the name of this type of room, but it's one of those surround sound, to put it lightly, surround sound black box performance spaces. But it's much more than surround sound. There are over 100 independent speaker channels in the room, and they go around you at the floor level and then above, and on the ceiling. So, of course, it just takes, electronic pieces that can be panned around the room to a whole new level. And we got to see a little demo on it, and it was really, really neat. Yeah. And, of course, there were the regular awesome Day of Percussion type events there as well. So Listen, our guest today has been called the Twin Cities Hungriest Young Percussionist by New Music Box. He teaches at the University of Minnesota Morris and is the principal percussionist of the Mankato Symphony Orchestra. Did I say that right, Scotty?
Mankato,
thank you.
It's the Native American name.
Got it. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, he's an active solo performer and clinician, and he's already an artist of Sabian and Vic Firth. So, hey, Scotty, how's it going?
Very good, Casey. Thanks for inviting me. This is I've been looking forward to this for a long time. It's really a pleasure to be on the show.
It's a big deal. At Percussion, it's
yeah, like, for sure.
Goes on everybody's resume now. Well, thanks. Yes, yeah, very happy to have you and glad to have you. What are you up to lately? And please give us a little update on what's happening with yourself.
Yeah, sure. Well, thankfully, very, very busy. And I don't have a full-time job. I actually have an adjunct position. So that's a blessing and a curse because I do a lot of, things around town, and I do travel quite a bit too. So it's a blessing and a curse in the sense that I do have more open time. I'm not just in one place every day for the same schedule. So I do play with the orchestra. I do a lot of freelancing things. I do timpani and percussion for a lot of the choirs and a lot of the orchestras. I do a lot of drum set gigs. And I have my own time to do my solo artist concerts, which is really my passion. So for projects now, I mean, I've been working with my students. I see all kinds of students over the course of the week, not just college students. I work with children a lot over the week in lessons. I have teens. I have my college students one or two days. As far as a project and stuff, right now I'm getting ready for the International Katarzyna Mieszka Marimba Academy. I'll be attending that actually as a student. I wanted to put myself in a student role again, so I said I'm not going to teach or be the, center of attention. I'm going to attend the Katarzyna Mieszka Academy, and then I'll be going to Portugal right before that, actually. So that's kind of that's what's on my mind right now.
Yeah, very cool. Where in Portugal will you be?
Well, I have my events are confirmed for Aveiro, and I have some pending things in Lisbon and Porto. Although Pedro Carneiro is my primary contact there, he's pretty booked up, so we might have some trouble getting together. But I will be visiting the University of Aveiro for a concert and a clinic.
Was that? Will you say that city one more time? That's not Ivora, is it?
Aveiro.
Okay, how do you spell that?
A-V-E-I-R-O.
Okay, so that is somewhere different. I visited this place called Ivora, and I did a quick little segment on it on the podcast. I forget what episode, but the guest name was Pedro Fernandez, if you want to see it. And
I know him.
Oh, great. Yeah, good. Yeah, what a guy. But there's this thing called the Chapel of Bones. So if you get a chance and if you're anywhere close by, I don't know, try to go to Ivor. I mean, it's also just a beautiful city and it's really, really interesting. And yeah, I don't know where else you can see something like that in the world.
Yeah. Thanks. I mean, when I travel and give my solo concerts and my clinics, I think over the years I've gotten better at really taking in the whole experience. And I think the first couple times I did international gigs, I was really worked up about being prepared and just doing my own thing. And you're right, I really want to take the time and experience the place and this the spirit and the energy of the place, you know what I'm saying? And also leave open time. I mean, I think when I used to do international gigs, I just booked things up as busy as I could, and I really didn't have the time to relax and really take in what was around me. So that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. You know, we do have a Facebook question for you since we're talking about your projects and the current things you're doing. My student Caleb Pickering has asked, can you please talk about... Yeah, do you know Caleb?
I think through Facebook briefly, and I've seen some of his stuff. His stuff is great. I think I watched some of his videos in their entirety one day, and I really liked it. Yeah.
We can't let his ego get too big, though. I'll edit that out.
So, okay.
We can't let him start thinking that too soon. Yeah, no, he's great, of course. So Caleb would like to know, can you please talk about your Snapshots of a Journey project and what sparked your interest in that?
Great. Thank you, Caleb. I really appreciate you asking that. Well, that's probably my most recently completed project. And with Snapshots of a Journey, I had a couple goals. I wanted to quite simply document all of my most recent contributions to performance and teaching. But I also wanted to do something that was, I hate to use the word accessible, but it made sense for someone to open up and visit. I didn't want to make like a really verbose or a really academic kind of looking thing that would shy away a lot of people. So those were my two primary goals with it. And then I guess my third goal was to not conform and just do like minute clips of me playing, which I see a lot of that and that's cool and everything, but I really wanted to commit to doing like 10 or 12 solid full presentations and take the blow of knowing that that's going to get me less views, but really just put a full presentation out there. And so the result is something I'm really proud of. And I think for those who want to sit down and listen to a 7 or 8 minute piece or a 20 minute lesson, they're going to get that solid full presentation. And it wouldn't join the family or the category of these clips, which I'm seeing as trends now on social media and stuff and YouTube, is just these very brief, sort of superficial clips. You know, I really wanted to say what I wanted to say with my best contributions that I had worked hard with in a full way online, and be able to share it in an organized way to anyone who wanted to take the time and do that. So that's the introduction, I guess. If you want to be more specific about the content in the program, I wanted to kind of do the Denny's or Perkins sampler kind of thing, meaning, you know, you can pick and choose your favorite kinds of things and you don't have to watch the whole thing from beginning to end. That's another thing I wanted to do, is not make something that was like a big academic, like a dissertation or I wanted to make kind of a sampler. So each video it's a collection, but each video is a standalone video that has a message from beginning to end. So if you have 10 minutes, you know, you can really take in that thing. And to be specific, I did some of my new repertoire pieces that I've done in tours the past 2 years. So Sciarrino's Il Legno e la Perola, which is a pretty obscure work for marimba. Ignatowitz Toccata, which Ben and I were talking about a little bit. We can talk about that more later if you want. And then some of my original compositions, so some of the progressive rock tunes with the marimba and the drums. And then just some various lessons, some of them beginner, some of them more college topics. So.
Cool. I have two questions, Scotty. One is, how many languages do you speak?
Well, in all fairness, really English. I mean, my which is not really a very impressive answer for someone that travels internationally, I know, but or an educated person. I'm forced to learn Spanish because Agu speaks Spanish to me all the time, even though she knows I don't speak Spanish. So it's like I have that desire to want to try to learn.
Yeah.
So I would say I'm pretty good with about 5% of Spanish. I can carry a basic conversation and Spanish and Portuguese. I can carry a basic conversation and I can follow along and listen to what's going on. And like if I go to a clinic from someone in Brazil or Argentina or whatever, I can get like 75% of it.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good. I was curious because
that's where I'm at right now. That's all I can do.
Like, I feel like a lot of us that are musicians, we're like really fluent in accents. Like we can say words and names and titles with accents.
Yeah, of course we're used to the subtleties of sound, so we can assimilate that really quick. But the vocabulary and it's just it's memorizing and it's experience and repetition, and I just don't have that.
Right. Yeah. Well, it takes so much time. And the thing I really wanted to ask you about is something that came up right before we started recording, where we figured out that we have these really similar interests in mind-body connection and health of musicians. And I know you've researched this a lot, did your dissertation on it. So I was wondering if you could just talk about your discoveries and how that goes into your teaching now, if at all.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's opening up a pretty intense can of worms, I know. So hopefully I answered Caleb's question adequately. Is that cool? So with regards to my dissertation topic and how that plays into how I give clinics now, it's a big can of worms. And in all seriousness, I think I scratched the surface when I wrote my dissertation, which is probably what most people say. After writing a dissertation, they realize that they have a good start to a topic, but it's like opening up a whole world of things, that you feel like you barely get a taste of. But I tried to narrow it down so I wouldn't have an erratic sounding dissertation, and I think the big discoveries that I made and that I wanted to present in a clear and cohesive way was that percussionists need a variety of ways to learn things. And that we need to implement that into our personal practice routines, and we need to implement that into our lesson plans and teaching. We want to be really informed, smart teachers as well. So in a nutshell, that was kind of my goal. I wanted to lay out as many different kinds of learning that one could experience with percussion, and more specifically, the ones that were a little more body aware or a little more self-aware. And one of my arguments is that classical music pedagogy in particular really fortified only one or two of them. And so I was interested in exploring some of the more alternative, I guess you could say, or holistic approaches to learning. If I had to talk about one or two of them, which is what I do in my clinics, the biggest distinction that I made, I think, in my research was, and I'm not sure if you've come across this discourse in your work, Laurel, but the distinction between declarative memory and non-declarative memory. Have you heard this particular terminology before?
No, explain it.
Well, as with anything with terminology, even percussion, we get really fussy about this, and different people have different ways of saying the same thing. And, this means that. But basically, non-declarative learning and declarative learning, there's a couple other synonymous things like explicit learning and implicit learning, or cognitive learning and experiential learning. So people have these different ways of illuminating these different polarities, I guess you could say, this yin and yang component of learning. And what I found in my research, most of which transcended just researching about percussion, found that these two types of learning were just so completely different from one another. And my argument was that percussionists and percussion teachers don't quite have the research chops to integrate this into their into their playing and into their teaching. So my goal with my dissertation was to lay out some of these things and then present some of the more alternative approaches in real good examples. So is that helping so far?
Yeah.
I have a related question for you guys, and I guess it's pretty general. Do you think it's our job as teachers to teach students beyond whatever the topic may be? You know, you're teaching a class on any topic. And I remember, Greg Beyer was talking about this in his episode, where like we're teaching a lot more than percussion. We're teaching them how to be good citizens, and we're teaching them a lot about life. And I think we all agree we want to do that, and that happens whether we mean for it to or not. But I've talked to other people and other teachers who get frustrated when they are told they're supposed to inspire and they're supposed to make the students like what their major is. And I don't know. I feel like I kind of go back and forth, you know, like I don't want to force you to like anything.
I think,
you know, like if you don't like this, that's cool, man. Go do something you like. I don't, you know, like is our job to motivate and inspire?
I mean, I think the short answer is yes. But for me, like, you can't talk about, I don't know, Brahms, for example, without talking about Beethoven and Bach first. Like, there's a lineage, and I think it's almost impossible to not teach outside of exactly what you're talking about, because, like, almost none of music exists in some sort of vacuum just within the art form. And that's not even accounting for like all the social, cultural factors, you know, outside of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, I mean, it's often, very often in lessons that I'll be talking about a piece or a timpani etude or excerpt or something like that, and I'll say, oh, go listen to this piece as well. And I do listening assignments a lot as a kind of way to hopefully inspire students. And then also, I mean, as an applied faculty, if you're not performing like faculty recitals or concertos or something like that, at least semi-regularly, like you're not doing your job. And that, to me, seeing my teachers perform was always hugely inspiring. So yes.
Yeah, I also have some insights about that. First of all, my first response to Casey's, the way that Casey put it, was it depends on the student. So first of all, I would say generally yes, but then I would say it depends on the student. And I really think as teachers, we can't force any kind of style of learning on one given student. And of course, it goes back to whether are you teaching classroom or are you teaching a private lesson. So if you're teaching a private lesson, I think it's really important to just be open to what kind of relationship you're going to have with this student. I have college students that are more like, okay, this is kind of business time, like I'm hard at work, it's nothing personal, I want to get this done correctly, I want to get my formal experience of the day completed. And I have to, as a teacher, I can't force a more personal or a more reflective approach on that time together, you know. I can't make really extraneous analogies to this student because it's how they're learning, you know. I guess what I'm trying to say is, as a teacher, I want to be open to how this student is going to make progress. And if I'm trying to reach them through an idea that I have, that I'm attached to, I'm not going to make a good connection with that student. That student's not going to make a lot of progress.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I think a good teacher knows the students well, and a good teacher is listening, not only just doing their thing. A good teacher is figuring out how is this student gonna learn and improve.
Yeah, no, I think that's of course well said. I guess I also think about, you know, say an evaluation for a classroom that you're teaching music appreciation. This is where Laurel and I bumped into this. You know, the class wasn't fun. Now, the teacher could be more entertaining, and actually, I happen to be a very entertaining teacher, so I happen to be really outward and and I try to make them laugh a lot. And I, you know, so I think I didn't suffer from this, but again, this is just, it's not personal thing for me, but I've talked to other teachers about it. And it's like, yeah, this is teaching. This isn't entertainment. And so I think it's a little different from what we were talking about before, but I feel like it's kind of in the same neighborhood.
I guess I have a pretty malleable viewpoint on teaching in general. I mean, I that's why talking about teaching is weird. It's like talking about performing music. It's like it really is based on the moment of, and it's based on the energy and the relationship you have with those particular students or that particular student in a private lesson. So I guess in that sense, I don't have a general answer, I guess. I would want to respond to the energy of that particular group of students in the best way of them learning. You know, I'm sorry to give sort of a bland answer, but the other thing too is, I guess the more deeper philosophical approach to your question, answer to your question would be, yes, it is important for us to inspire and to connect percussion to other areas, because think about how old our field is, you know what I'm saying? In terms of music, I mean, hitting two things together, two rocks or pieces of wood together, I mean, we have such an ancient tradition here that we're working with. Of course, bigger issues are going to come up when we talk to our students about other things like health and wellness, of course, which I'm sure both Laurel and I agree are intrinsically connected to percussion. We're gonna bring up this idea of health and wellness. We might even bring up things like personal values and even religion and spirituality or whatever. These things are going to come up when we talk about percussion. And I think, would we get hired to do a job if we just had a good resume and we just had the skills and the knowledge? Of course, but I come from a family of teachers, and I want to follow after some of the examples that my grandfather and my parents set as just being really passionate educators. And of course, so my answer would be yes. I think we do have to give them all we got.
Yeah, I have a question for you guys that are like from generations of teachers, because I am not. My family is not full of teachers. How do you deal with the students that, you know, like we're always griping about? They seem very unmotivated. They're not doing anything. So as like people who have generations of mentors around you, what advice would you have?
I usually just hit them.
No, you don't.
You wouldn't hurt a fly, man. You're the kind of guy that I can tell that you...
I think for me, one of the... I think we kind of hit on this with Michael Rosen a bit. Like one of the tenets of being a teacher, especially like a one-on-one relationship, like a, you know, music professor, is just honesty. And no one likes to be told you're wrong. So I don't generally phrase it as you're wrong. I always go for, I know what you're capable of. You know what you're capable of, and you're not living up to your own standard. But yeah, I think just a huge thing is honesty. And Casey and I were talking about this a bit earlier before we were on the call. But yeah, it's just, it's not fun as a teacher to be telling a student you're not doing well, but you have to sometimes. It just sucks. It's part of the job. And it's nothing personal, and it doesn't need to be done in some sort of rude way. But yeah,
my heart gets broken when I have to have that talk with one of my little.
Yeah,
kids.
I mean it sucks. Like I've had a student not pass a recital hearing, and it's like I didn't want that to happen any more than you wanted that to happen. You know, like it's not fun. It sucks.
Well, and I think it's a sign of, I think all this is very related. So if you're really passionate about what you're teaching, it's going to be like Scotty said, inspired, and it's going to be entertaining, probably, because it's going to be interesting and motivating and have energy, and you're going to be giving it all you have, like Scotty said. So I think it hurts, you know, it does hurt when a student's not doing well in this thing that we love so much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably a good testament to what's going on. But I don't know. I also think sometimes you just have to step back and not change what this is actually supposed to be about. You know, I worry sometimes that people say like, okay, this thing that we're supposed to be teaching isn't working for this person, so I'm going to change what this thing is to mold it to this person. When really the person, it's complicated. You know, I think we need to be careful not to change what we're doing. Like, we don't want to change our mission statement of the craft to.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? And I worry that that has started to happen a little bit in some of the things I'm seeing. And I'm sorry. I love the institutions I work at. I love the field, and I love the students. But I'm sorry. I think I love the craft first and foremost. You know.
And for me, I come from an interesting perspective in this particular discussion because I am not a full-time professor right now. So many days out of the week, and I feel no shame because of this. I love that I do other things. Of course, my goal is to have a full-time position, but I also really love that I'm in the opportunity of doing other things. And in my case, my contribution to this question is like, I work with students from so many different backgrounds in so many different contexts. You know what I'm saying? So if I'm in a college teaching position and a role, of course, I'm going to address this from a certain perspective. Like, you're getting a grade. I have, like Casey said, I have a very specific job here. I have to have a sense of professionalism with what we're doing right here and now, you know. Now, if I'm talking to one of the children that I see private lessons, you know, 9 or 10 year old kid who's, you know, whose parents have signed him up to step to take weekly lessons with me, then, you know, it's a different feel. It's a different structure. There's a little more mentorship there. Of course, I totally like what Casey said about honoring the craft and that we're carrying a tradition here and we have a responsibility to, you know, for me, it's passing what I learned from Fernando Mesa and Stuart Mars. I feel a great sense of responsibility with that. But outside of this institutionalized system, I feel like I can step more into the personal mentor role with some of these, you know, especially with some of the children. Because also, a 10-year-old or 11-year-old kid doesn't, or even 6 or 8, you get one of these guys in lessons, you know, these kids don't really understand the professional distinction between a percussion teacher and a coach or a doctor. I mean, they don't think like adults yet. So they just see an adult who's exemplifying something and they want to mimic that, you know? So anyway,
well said. That makes a ton of sense. And I think in that case, you're totally right. And I guess I should clarify, just so I don't sound too much like a old school mean teacher. It's like you're definitely passing on this craft, and you're definitely keeping the craft what it is. But I think that's ultimately what is best for the students. You know, like keep the, and that is what being a good teacher is. I notice when teachers don't, or like let's say you're in a master class and it's not the person giving the master class or the clinic, it's just not going well. You get a sense they just don't have a firm idea what to say, or they don't know what to say, or they're winging it as far as what to come up with.
I know, man.
That's not about passion or about understanding what the students' needs are. That's about knowing the craft. So they need to know the craft better. They don't need to, you know, find some other way to get to the student or be more entertaining or something. It's no. You need to know the craft better and have stronger convictions in the craft so that they can come through you in a passionate way.
Well, that reminds me of a conversation that I had with Fernando Mesa, who, you know, Fernando Mesa for me is like, I mean, he's like, he's one of my best friends. I consider him like, you know, he's my mentor. He's been my role model.
Yeah.
And I think about him every day. You know, I certainly don't see him every day, but I think about him every day. And
his big break was being a guest on the show. You know that, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. And he told me once that, because we were talking about performance and teaching, and I had a headspace 5 or 6 years ago where my head was spinning about performing versus teaching, and Fernando really helped me understand that they're so much more connected than I was than I was thinking, that you want to be an artist teacher. And when he said that, that word, that term kind of just sit perfectly in my head. Like, you want to be so in as one of Neil Peart's mentors used to say, Freddie Gruber used to say, infected with the God of the craft. Not to say that it has to be spiritual or religious or whatever, but so intensely into what you're doing that teaching just comes with it. I mean, of course you have to be a well-studied teacher, but you're so into what you're doing that 30 minutes in a lesson goes by like that because you're so intense about it. Now, we've all seen these like really pedestrian, uptight teachers who are just boring, you know? Like you said, you're saying entertaining, you know? That word kind of has weird baggage to it for some people, but when you're this really diffuse, kind of stiff desk kind of percussion teacher guy, it's like, it's disappointing. It's like, that's not motivating or inspiring. When you're into what you're doing, like, Casey was like, I was just practicing. You know, it's like, I'm doing the same. I practice, I teach a lesson, I'm practicing, I perform. And it's like, it all becomes a soup. So, you know, and that's good. I'm saying that in a good way. So that when I'm in a lesson with a student, I'm so pumped up about something that it carries over into my teaching. And I think that supports Casey's idea of being intensely into the craft, is that for me, it's just a little bit of a spiritual thing. I don't want to impose that on the discussion, but it's like the spirit of the drum or the spirit of the music is so in the air that you can't help but sort of ride its wave. And that comes from years of dedication, it comes from practice, it comes from teaching, it comes from performance experience. But I think a good teacher is going to, it's going to be contagious with a good teacher.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And man, I mean, look, and I feel so fortunate for who I've had as mentors. I mean, being 5 years studying with Fernando Mesa, you know, I mean, who's better than Fernando Mesa?
He's awesome.
He's a perfect role model.
I really, really like the word contagious. I find myself using that word too. And speaking of jobs, I know in my job interview, they asked me here, how are you going to motivate students? And I said, it's tricky because there's not a quick magic pill solution, but you have to create a contagious atmosphere and you have to create a culture that's going to take a while to create.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no like kind of one quick solution of thing you can say or whatever. And I get frustrated because sometimes, you know, friends or maybe a friend who comes by and visits the school and gives a little masterclass or a private lesson, Laurel, you know exactly what I'm talking about, but they tell you later like, oh yeah, I just gave so-and-so their lesson. Did you know that they do this and that when they play? You should really say something. It's right. Yeah. Cause I've never said something about that. Thanks. Yes. Thank you so much. If
Did
only
I
they had been told. No, it wasn't you.
But
I do find it funny though. Like when I have a guest in, the guest will say the exact same thing as I said, but because someone else said it, it's like taken as more valuable.
For the moment they take it so seriously because they're in this social situation, but are they going to go and like really fix it? Usually not. So people really think, oh, there must be some magic thing that you can just say. And in the case I'm talking about, oh, you should really talk to them about that. Yeah, man, you think I haven't said something about that? That's not the thing. The thing is this much harder long-term project of making a contagious culture, that's why it's called a studio. It's a contagious studio atmosphere and culture where they just do these things and they want to have this soup and this thing in the air that you're talking about.
It's not all conscious, you know, that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, and listen, you know, there's no quick fix to anything. I mean, it's a simple.
You know, for the kid who has the contagent, is that the right word? The contagent?
Contagent.
I think you know what I mean. Like has the bug we're talking about, you can make quick fix comments like that to them. You can say, oh, hey, by the way, you'll get to that spot better on the instrument if you quit doing that goofy thing with your elbow. And they go, oh, right, thanks, because they've got the bug and they respond to that, you know, and then it's suddenly another thing you've thrown up in the air.
Yeah, the other thing too, I think, and this goes a little bit, as bizarre as it sounds, back to Laurel's question about my dissertation topic, which was holistic awareness and how we can learn percussion from a variety of angles. One of my arguments in my dissertation was that in classical music, we tend to just think that everything is this conscious decision. And that's why I said the word conscious earlier. Like, it's not all conscious. It's not all like deliberate decisions about what sticking for the De La Cluse etude. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that learning classical music can get us into these very rigid kind of habits. And when you do have music in the air, this sort of spiritual language that some people find really, they get really cynical about, it's like, when, you know, for me, when I'm in the room with Fernando Mesa, I can't help but be inspired to play. End of story. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And meaning if he generates that kind of musicianship, that kind of power with his playing and his demonstrations and his personality and his love for percussion, I'm intrinsically going to follow the things that he's doing. You know what I'm saying? It's not like he's doing something in particular or saying something in particular. It's that he's generating, and he's transmitting the lineage. He's transmitting the art form. He's transmitting the music, and the student feels inclined to follow, you know? That's my feelings about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, Laurel has a bit of a topic that I think pertains somewhat to your dissertation, right, Laurel?
Yeah, well, certainly more the conversation here and now. The dissertation, I'll leave it to Scotty to decide how much it relates. But I found with some students that seem to like never quite do the work they need to be doing. You know, and if I've kind of exhausted my little box of I'm going to be the supportive mentor, okay, I'm going to be a little bit harder on you. Okay, now I'm going to talk about the short-term consequence of the grade, and I'm going to talk about the long-term consequence of the freshmen that auditioned are better than you. That's a problem. And you say you want to teach, but the freshmen are better than you. That's a problem, you know. I start to wonder about perhaps how these students are approaching what they're doing, and connected to a previous topic I did about practice and whether it's a compulsion or an addiction, and we would interpret normally, I'm so addicted to practice as a good thing. It got me thinking about self-sabotage as musicians and how perhaps some of the things we do when we know we need to prepare for something, whether it's a lesson or professionally, whether it's the next job application or the next recital or the next tour, whatever it is, there are probably things that we do that are forms of self-sabotage. And basically, psychologists consider anything self-sabotaging to be something that gets in your own way of your own goals, that you're doing by choice, however kind of subliminally that choice is. So they list four main things that are self-sabotaging. One is to dodge emotions / self-medicate. Two is procrastination. The third is addiction, any addiction. And then the last one, which is one of my personal favorites, is extreme modesty, is a form of self-sabotage. So I get to thinking about these dodging emotions. So, you know, I was in a lesson just last week, and I don't know if our students listen to these podcasts, but he'll know who he is. and I was about to gripe
at
Caleb?
Him. It was Caleb?
It was yeah, not
it was Caleb.
Pickering.
No, not Caleb. Yep, no
doubt. And, yeah, I said, I'm about to gripe at you. Prepare yourself. You know, like, prepare yourself. And I just got this attitude immediately. Like, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to deal with it. And he was just dodging everything about it. And he just said, no, I know. And yeah, I just don't like this. I just don't like this piece. That's what it is. And I said, well, I would believe you, except you haven't really practiced anything. So I don't believe you. Which gets me into thinking, you're dodging me in this moment. And then what are you doing in your free time? Because it's never a pleasant experience to be griped at by a teacher, ever. It's not pleasant for the teacher or the student, you know, and so you know it's coming. So what are you doing instead? Which leads to thing number two, which is procrastination. Whereas if you have a compulsion to practice, you're so worried about that negative outcome in a lesson that you practice, that you get it done. So you avoid that negative emotional experience. But the self-sabotage part, I don't want to have that negative experience, and I'm going to just avoid everything that has to do with it. So you procrastinate and you do all of this other stuff instead of the few things that you need to do. And so the article that I'm referring to is from Psychology Today. And they say, procrastination, we make an intention to act, time comes, but instead of acting, we get lost in our own deliberation, making excuses to justify an unnecessary and potentially harmful delay. Who makes this decision? We do. The self, in fact, sabotages its own intention. I feel like procrastination can be really related to addiction. So we tend to think of addiction as like substance abuse, but it's not necessarily that only. It's just having a desire to engage in pleasurable activities, whatever they are. Some people are really social creatures, and so they gain so much like pleasure from being around other people. Maybe they're really extroverted that they can't say no to those things. Or perhaps they're so dependent on one other person in some relationship that whenever that relationship has issues, they can't do anything else because they're so addicted to that dependency. Lastly, and I know I see some me's from people in the chat, so I definitely want to hear from everyone if you so desire. The last one, extreme modesty, is something that, interestingly, the psychologist's list is something that women are really good at, and I don't want to make that part of the conversation today necessarily, but just our ability to not be egotistical, because we know that egotistical behavior is extremely disruptive of any social climate, right? Of any studio atmosphere. To be incredibly egotistical interrupts everything, and it makes you hard to work with, it makes you hard to interact with on a personal level, and in the end, it makes you untrustworthy if you make enough mistakes. People don't trust anything you say, and so I wonder if part of our sort of social adaptations of how to get along within a group, like a studio, like a professional field of musicians. We do small things that are a little bit, you know, self-effacing is one of the terms that they use, but we kind of jokingly put ourselves down or be like, yeah, I don't quite know how to, I don't know how to talk to three-year-olds, I don't know, which comes from something I saw someone do at the Day of Percussion. There was this group of seven-year-olds that played all these ORF instruments, and we were supposed to give comments, and I was just like, I have no experience with this. I don't know what to do, but I saw someone else just like, he just rocked it. It was great. It was Matthew Coley. It was so impressive. It was fantastic, you know, but I realized like, wow, okay. So, you know, the desire to not seem like you know everything could potentially come back to, you know, bite you in the rear, so to speak, as they say. So I feel like, you know, on a personal note, the extreme modesty is something that I'm going to work on. But yeah, I'm sure we all do our little things. And Casey, you said you had something. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
I just now realized that you guys are using chat too.
Oh yeah, we communicate with the chat. Yeah, we
joke around and communicate.
It's probably best to ignore it, honestly.
I was saying something or like kind of talking about something, and then I just heard like, what's going on?
Oh yeah, the chat's so useful. You know, I thought, Laurel, going back to what we said before, when a student is saying, I just don't enjoy this, I think it's the same thing. Like, this isn't motivating me. This isn't entertaining me. I don't care if it's entertaining you. That's not what we're here to do, you know? So I feel like it's related to what we were saying before, you know?
Oh, and, yeah.
And you show students certain pieces of music, and I'm just not enjoying this Shostakovich. You think he cares if you like it? Do you know what this guy lived through? Do you really think his first and foremost point is to like make you smile and enjoy this? Come on, you know. So
I'm kind of feeling in outer space right now, like as to how to contribute to the.
Oh.
anyways, I don't know. Just keep on going. I'm kind of.
Oh sure. Fading. Yeah, no, that's really all I had. But I think that's the, you know, what you experienced in that lesson might be symptomatic of that expectation. This assignment isn't entertaining me, or it's not motivating me, or whatever. It's like, well, wait a minute. Is that what we're always supposed to be doing? What about I think it's also okay to tell students, hey, you don't have to enjoy this. Stop trying to have enjoyment all the time. Sometimes work is just hard. That's why it's called work.
Exactly. I want to ask, like, do you go up to your statistics professor after a lecture and tell him, I'm not entertained by this.
Exactly.
Can you find something else that
Exactly,
and
that's what I was saying before. You know, like, I just don't know if it's a fair precedent to put on all teachers. And I think I am an entertaining teacher. You know, I think I was a really entertaining music appreciation teacher, and I think I was really, really, really passionate about it. Sorry, what do you got there, Scotty?
Can I add something?
Yeah, go ahead. I finally got on the train tracks of what
this is borderline irrelevant, but I just wanted to share. There is a fantastic article from The Onion, and the headline of this article is "Professor Deeply Hurt by Students' Evaluation," and I just wanted to read the first paragraph of it. It says, Leon Rothberg, PhD, a 58-year-old English professor at Ohio State University, was shocked and saddened Monday after receiving a subpar mid-semester evaluation from freshman student Chad Berner. The circles labeled 4 and 5 on the Scantron form were predominantly filled in, placing Rothberg's teaching skill in the below-average to poor range. And it's amazing. If you want to read that article, it's exactly what we're talking about right now.
Okay. I think I have something to contribute. I've been... Like I was watching the Stephen Chick episode, and Stephen, as usual, said something. All it took was three words to say for him to say something brilliant. He said, "I prefer to listen. I'm just listening." Or someone said, one of you guys was like, "Hey, Stephen, what do you have to say about that?" And he's like, "No, I just prefer to listen." And I was like, "Wow, that's really cool. I really admire that." So I think I got a reply to this. I was kind of lost in outer space for a minute, but now I think I have a response. And I'm going to try to respond to the morals, you know, contribution in the simplest way I can, which is I try not to overanalyze these kinds of things, and I try to simply exemplify a good role model. You know what I'm saying? That is my only response to the whole thing. It's like I give students good feedback about what they're doing, but I think the most important thing is just to exemplify a good role model. And these teacher evaluation kind of things are good, or asking, like sometimes in a lesson I'll ask a student, am I going too fast? Am I demonstrating too much? Or, you know, these little things. But I think above all, I really believe that students respond to a role model. Meaning if you simply exemplify the things, instead of talk about them or kind of overanalyze them, if you simply exemplify the things that you want to see in your students that you believe are important, slowly but surely, many of them will probably start exhibiting similar behavior. And I know you guys are probably more talking about college students, but I'm also from day to day thinking about children too, and I know it's a different issue. But with children, do this like crazy. Children imitate, I mean, and I'm talking about little things like faces, like marimba faces, stuff like that, to really big picture things like practice habits and like speech things. I mean, they just emulate, you know? So I suppose that's my response, is that I believe and trust that if I provide a good role model and just set a good example, then the students will start to make a good difference, you know? Is that resonating with the discussion? Did you feel like it was...
I mean, for me, one of the most role model sort of things was the fact that Mark Ford on his office door, like many of us do, had his schedule posted, and every morning from like 10 to noon it said practice, and there was a sign that said, you know, please do not interrupt during practice hours unless it's an emergency or something like that. And like 5 days a week he was there at the times he said he was going to be practicing. And it also kind of struck me how little that seemed to me. Like, Mark Ford practices 2-3 hours a day, something like that, but it's every single day. So yeah, that had a huge effect on me at a young age. And then I like just watching all of my teachers perform, I can pick out things that all of them do that I subconsciously picked up in my playing. I made a little joke like about this on Facebook this week. Yeah, like, I picked up some of Svet's weird, passionate performance habits. But there's equally the way Christopher Dean will come off of a note when he finishes a phrase or something. I definitely, like, my role models definitely had a huge effect on me as a performer.
And back to the research question, back to the research discussion that Laura and I were talking about, and also about different learning styles, you know, since we were babies, we learned through imitation. It's one of the most powerful types of learning. I mean, you could talk about pedagogy all day. You could talk about lesson planning all day. But let's get down to basics here. People, no matter what level of academia you're in, people learn through imitation. And this goes, you know, Laurel, this goes from anywhere from a motor skill to a social behavior to a cognitive skill. We learn through imitation. And if we see animals do this, you know what I'm saying? Animals do this. So this is a very fundamental way that we learn, that our brains and bodies process new information, our brains and the motor parts of our brains process new information. I mean, and it just goes back to the stiff academia kind of thing. It's like coming from a rock background. It's like, sometimes it's just like when I feel that things are getting too stuffy or too academic, I'm like, whoa, man, it's like, chill out for a second. How do you do this? Do it. Or you want to watch me do something? Just watch and do it. You know what I mean? There's an over analytical zone that you need to stay away from.
I think you can over strategize very easily.
I agree with that. And I think where I, and I know Casey, because we talk about it, get immensely frustrated is when, like, I know I'm setting an example because I'm there practicing, and I, like, don't eat during the day because I'm practicing. And I, you know, I'll be with a student, and me, who's not focused on her snare drum chops for years, can outplay someone who's been, like, focusing on them. We have... like, that's an issue, you know, and so it becomes frustrating of like, okay, I put the work in early and I can demo things to you and you work on them for a few weeks and they don't change. That says to me you're not working, and I don't know what other example you're supposed to set.
That's where you would need to get more specific. I mean, that sounds like an example to me where you need to give the student specific, and we're having these really great general kind of conversations today, which I really like, but that's where you need to get specific, meaning how many minutes a day are you practicing your paradiddle diddle? Are you bending your wrist? You know, are you working with a metronome for 15 minutes starting with a slow tempo? You know, that's where you need to get really specific. And like you said, I think you said something to the effect of like, someone's process is not solid with how they're practicing, you know, and that's where the teacher, as a good teacher, you know how to step in and give someone very concise, specific advice, which I find hard to do when I give a public clinic, because it's easy to get in these big kind of subjective conversations about playing philosophy and things. And sometimes when someone asks a question in a clinic, and it's a public situation, and I'm sure Casey, you've been in this situation probably 100 times, where it's like you're in front of 50 or 100 people or whatever, and someone asks you a question, and you have two choices. You can go on a long artistic rant about the question, or you can answer the question really concisely, and the student whether they listen or not is up to them, but they have a pretty specific, objectifiable way to address the issue, you know? And so... In that case, Laura, I would say that that's the time to get specific. And I think a good teacher knows how to be concise with that without going on an unclear kind of rant. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so, great.
Casey, what's your feeling? Can you maybe do a tangent on that with regard, or not a tangent, but can you build on that with regards to your experience giving clinics, like answering questions, for giving a long answer versus giving an attendee a concise answer?
Yeah, sure. I think it goes along with what you're passionate about at that moment. So I think the same thing happens in a classroom situation. You know, depending on how you're feeling about a certain topic, if it's going to be really energetic and impassioned and hopefully inspiring and motivating, then yeah, sure, milk it. I find my mood has so much to do with how I'll address that question. If I feel like taking it to a really long extent and trying to make a broader, bigger point, because I mean, how many times, there's so many places they can get, hey, I'm having this thing with how I hold the sticks, or I want to get my flams this way. If they're asking questions like that, I feel like there's so many places they can get the answer to that I try to, it's like, okay, what can I do specifically? So I always try to get it around to something that I can give them that they're likely not going to get anywhere, even though it might not be the quick little answer tidbit they wanted. I would rather still give them that. And they might go away thinking, oh, he didn't answer my question, but they might have gotten something that was really better than what they wanted to know, because they can get what they wanted to know real easily, and they're going to like trip over it if they just dig a little bit, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome.
That reminds me of, I have a quick anecdote to share. One of my favorite things about Portraits and Rhythm is that it has musical indications in it, like number 3 says Marendo in it. And I always tell students, look that up.
I was just teaching number 3 today to somebody.
And, yeah, and it's a new thing. I started it like a week or two ago. When I ask, what does Marendo mean? And they don't know. I pull out my phone and I put on a timer and I say, okay, pull out your phone and Google it. And it's, and then it, like when they find out, I stop and I'm like, look, it took you 12 seconds to figure that out. Yeah, why couldn't you, did you not have 12 spare seconds this entire week that you could have just looked that up?
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, it's like, I could tell you, I know what it means, but yeah, it's way more valuable if you realize how quickly you can figure it out yourself.
That's a solid answer, Casey. That is a solid answer to my question, because it's like, I hate to say this as a teacher, if it's a stupid question, you know, there's no such thing as a stupid question, but if it's a legit stupid question, it's like, how do you turn it into an insightful response? You know what I'm saying? And I really, that's a really good, the other thing too, Laurel, actually, that might connect to what you're saying before is one good mark of a good teacher is knowing how to ask your students questions. It's like ricochet it back to them and ask them a question. Or sometimes in clinics, I'll ask them, can you be more specific? Have you ever said that at a clinic, Casey? Like,
yeah, hey, for sure.
Can you be more specific? Because people will ask these kind of foggy questions. And that's cool and everything, you know? But it's like, it's okay for a teacher to ricochet it back and say, I want you to think a little more critically about what you're asking here. You
know? Yeah, in fact, I said it just yesterday at the clinic I was giving. I say, hey guys, I'm not good at talking at people. I'm good at talking with people. So please just talk with me. But yeah, instead of saying, will you be more specific? I'll just start trying to have a dialogue with them. And thus they end up being more specific, whether they meant to or not. I guess I should also add, if they do want a quick answer, how do I do this little quick tidbit thing? You can answer it quickly and turn it into a longer thing for them as well. Because, I think if you're interested in it, you're going to speak in an interesting way and you're going to have an interesting delivery and people are going to like it. So, yeah, sometimes the biggest challenge is keeping yourself interested, because we've talked about a lot of these things over and over and over. In fact, even with this podcast, there are certain questions that the guests get that, man, I just don't want to hear answered again, you know, like. Because the answers aren't that different. You know what I mean? There's only so many variations to, you know, what inspires you as a composer. We hear that over and over and over. And I've heard that answer over and over and over on the podcast and out in the world, in clinics. Man, the answer is kind of the same out there. I mean, it really is. It's not that different. And you can even go to writers of books, that the answer is not that different. There's these subtle variations to what inspires you to to write this stuff. So I don't know. Yeah, I always try to take those types of questions and go like, okay, these answers are abundantly out there. What can I contribute? You know, what can I contribute? You know, this person asking, it's totally fair. They asked it. They just don't know this information is like everywhere in the ether. So what can I do to, you know, make this interesting for everyone, including myself right now?
And the other thing that comes to mind when you say that is like, we live in such a digitally accessible world that we have to remember, because live music, coming from the rock community, like live music sucks, man. It's suffering so bad, you know, like live music venues are closing down. Fewer people are going out to see bands. Fewer people are going out to see, even classical music, all that.
Oh yeah.
And, it's really sad. So we have to remind ourselves what can we do in these public events that is not going to happen when you're sitting looking at a computer screen.
Yeah.
Like, what can we do to make this a visceral, real experience, an integrated thing, instead of just watching someone on YouTube?
Yeah, no, you're totally right. Yeah, well, wow, you guys, we could keep going on this for quite a while, but actually, Laurel and I have to get to a dinner.
Yeah, no problem.
So, man, Ben, Laurel, thanks so much for joining, and everyone, thanks for joining us on episode 90. And, man, Scotty Horry, great to catch up with you, buddy.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It's such a pleasure to be on the show. I mean, a lot of the other people on this show are people I've looked up to that I've known, and so to be able to share a discussion with you three guys makes me really happy. So thank you so much.
Oh yeah, you're very welcome. Well, I'm always happy when it turns into a discussion like that. So yeah, thank you for making that happen so easy.
Sure, we talked a lot about teaching in particular. You know, mentorship and some of these things aren't talked about a lot. I mean, we could have talked about a lot of things, like, you know, we were bouncing around some of these ideas through Facebook messages today, but I'm glad we got to talk about the deeper sense of mentorship and teaching that goes into what we do.
You know? Yeah, likewise. All right, everybody, thank you so much. Catch you on 91.